When someone you love deeply is suffering from an illness they can't bear and medicine can't cure, you'd probably sacrifice just about anything to ease their agony. But what if the thing you have to give up is that person? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Robin Williamson's mom was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis as a young mother of 38. She tried her best to be a good sick person, one who didn't want to burden other people with the pain and disability and anxiety that go along with the disease that, on top of everything else, is wildly unpredictable. But by the time Robin was in her 20s, her mom was thinking about ending her life. And in early 2020, before COVID shut down most of the world, the family gathered for the final weeks before their mother would end her life on her own terms at a facility outside Zurich where physician-assisted suicide is legal. Robin Williamson is an author currently completing her MFA at UC Riverside. Her essay for The Audacity was titled The Switzerland Schedule. Robin, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So your mom had been sick for a long time before she and your dad told you and your siblings about her MS diagnosis. What do you know about when she began to experience what were probably the first symptoms of the disease and how long she had to wait for a diagnosis?
That's a really good question. It's something I still haven't, there's still quite a lot of details around that that are a little bit hazy for me, right? So I know that she had some experiences of, of numbness, of some paralysis in her legs back when we lived in Singapore, which is around between 1990 and 1993. So when I was two until when I was five, and that was around the time when she got a formal diagnosis. But there were, hints of symptoms that went back to even before I was born. And I know that she got some other diagnoses on the way. I would be able to tell you the name of one of the other diagnoses, but I would have to look it up. But it took a while to get there in terms of getting a formal diagnosis.
Just so we have a baseline understanding of this, I know you're not a physician, but broadly speaking, how does multiple sclerosis damage people's bodies?
So it's an autoimmune disease. And from what I understand, from a very untechnical perspective, is that, really it's the body that is damaging itself. MS seems to center around a kind of wearing away of the myelin sheath, which is a protective sheath around, I really hope I'm getting this right, a protective sheath around the nervous system. And that seems to kind of cause any number of problems to the rest of the body.
I think that works fine, and I apologize for putting you on the spot, but for folks who had no familiarity with the disease, I just wanted to get that out there. Were you aware, Robin, as a small child, that your mom had health challenges?
You know, that's always a really good question, right? And it's one for therapy, I think, because I feel like we, when we're very small, we pick up on a lot. We're extremely sensitive, right? Our mother is our primary caregiver. And so we are probably very aware of things without even knowing that we're aware. But I wasn't consciously aware of anything when I was a small child. And even if I had been, I don't think, when we're small children, we don't really know. We don't have any other mothers or fathers, right? We only have the life we have. So I don't think I would have had any reference point really to have understood it at the time.
What about, do you have any memory that tells you that your father was caring for her in a particular way before you realized she had a serious illness?
From when I was young, I would say not really. My dad worked a lot as well back in those days, right? So, when he retired, he was, you know, with her all the time, and playing a much more notable role of care in her life. But there was nothing that would have told me that this was going on when I was a very young child.
What do you remember about the day your parents did tell you about the diagnosis?
You know, I wrote about this in the essay, and I think one of the challenges I had about writing about this in the essay is how limited my memory is. Like, I really have flashes. You know, I kind of remember the villa that we were in, or the place we were staying in. We were on holiday in Spain. And I vaguely remember a table for some reason. And my dad spoke to me and my two older brothers together. And he was very, very serious. And, you know, I wasn't too young at the time, but I think I had a hard time making sense of why he was so serious, because I'd never heard of multiple sclerosis. So I think a part of me was like, oh, you know, she's got some illness. You know, illnesses are bad, but maybe she'll recover. And, you know, so I remember the day feeling this gravity, but at the same time, I feel like I also didn't quite fully register what a significant day it was.
It's maybe not so unusual for a teenager, right? At the time, you're so wrapped up in your own life. I wonder, though, to the extent that you maybe didn't feel the full weight of that sinking in right away, looking back, do you think your parents assumed you did understand, or maybe they were hoping that they could tell you the diagnosis without making you worry about it?
That's a really good question. I want to give it some thought. I think they wanted us to understand, right? Because I think they chose their timing. You know, they chose to tell us at a time where they felt things are going to get a lot worse. So, you know, they chose to tell us at a time when things would become more noticeable for us. And yes, as a small children, maybe we're not so good at picking up on some big news on a cognitive level. But if we see someone who we love, who is struggling and who is in pain, we're gonna notice that, right? And we're gonna feel that in various ways. So I think they did want us to understand, because I think they wanted us to be prepared for what was going to come.
MS is infamous for being wildly unpredictable, which has to make it especially stressful for patients, even during times when the disease is in remission, right? Because you cannot be sure when the other shoe might drop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was always one of the hardest things about it. For my mother and for all of us, right? Because even when it was in remission, there's always that question of like, well, when is it gonna accelerate again? But also it is quite unpredictable in terms of symptoms, right? So, you know, my mother didn't know whether she was going to lose her eyesight at some point, or whether she was going to see kind of drastic cognitive decline, or whether the kind of the painful jumps and spasms she got would start spreading to other parts of her body. So there are so many different ways that it can develop, and the pacing of that development was always, you know, was always very variable as well. So you're always, for want of a better term, you're always on the edge of your seat in terms of, you know, what's going to happen next and how life might get harder.
How did your mom cope when her symptoms were very bad? Were there medications and treatments that could help her feel better?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know the full extent of her medical regime. I would see her pill boxes, and there were many, many pills in them. And some of these were painkillers. I think there were, by the end, there were quite a lot of different kinds of painkillers that were all piled up on one another. And I'm sure they were having an effect, but they weren't effective enough. And then I think that she had medications that were designed to, you know, to treat symptoms as well. And she would also, you know, for a long period of time, she did a lot of work in terms of diet. I remember, I think it was, you know, kind of before, at least for me, before I heard about people always talking about antioxidants, she was obsessed with kale. She was eating kale, and she was eating raw carrots and raw vegetables all of the time. And it was kind of incredible, because I would, you know, I would have a few bites and I would be like, I don't know how you eat a full meal of this. But she was, you know, she was quite disciplined, because she was just really looking. There's a lot of books out there and websites and so on that kind of say, like, if you follow this diet, or if you do this thing, it's going to manage your MS symptoms, or it's going to make it all go away. It, you know, it saved my life, and so on. So she would try some of these things, and invariably, you know, maybe some of them would help. There's definitely no harm in eating healthily, but invariably they'd lead to disappointment, because ultimately her symptoms would just keep getting worse.
Yeah, it's understandable, right? Because it is, as hard as it is to control what you eat, that's easier than controlling, you know, a progressive disease that is wrecking your body.
Right, exactly. I mean, MS is, you know, the MS, and I have to say, I'm thinking, like, I really don't know how accurate my description of how the disease functions was at the beginning of this call, but you know, it's kind of operating in the background, whatever is happening, whatever it's doing. And I think there's a lot that still isn't understood about it. It's kind of, you know, it's there behind the scenes, it's behind the curtain, and it's continuing to make its moves, and you can't really know what your, you know, what your dietary changes or your regime changes. You can't really know how that is affecting those, you know, behind the scenes operations.
Did it feel safe to ask her how she was feeling on any given day, or was that a question the family avoided unless it was obvious?
I would always check in on how she felt whenever we spoke. And she felt very comfortable sharing with me how she felt. I wouldn't really need to ask a lot of the time. She would always express herself.
Robin, you write in the piece that your mom worked to be a good kind of sick person. What do you think that meant for her?
You know, it's funny. I don't always know if it's her that did that work, so much as I feel like people would impose that upon her.
Hmm.
Right, they would, you know, because she was someone with a great sense of humor, and she had a very sharp mind. She was very intelligent. She could make people laugh. I feel like because she had those qualities, it allowed people to look at her and talk about her, and frame a narrative of, you know, look how brave this person is. They're an inspiration to us all. And you know, I think from her perspective, she was often really wanting to scream to the rafters about how much suffering she was in. So I don't know if it's a case entirely of her presentation as much as it is of how willing people are to hear about suffering and to hear about sickness, right? And some people approach it by kind of focusing on a more positive story, on a more heroic narrative, and other people, and you know, my parents lost a lot of friends when my mum was sick, right? People slowly start to vanish because they don't want to spend time with things that are difficult and scary and challenging to them, you know, or that, you know, are restrictive in some ways, right? Like, you know, someone in a wheelchair who's in a lot of pain isn't always going to be able to like partake so freely in all the same activities, right? So does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah.
And as wonderful as your mom was, you did witness over time the disease and maybe that isolation in combination with it taking a toll on her personality and her confidence. What did that look like?
You know, I think one of the things the essay is about, as much as anything else, is also memory, right? I wrote most of the essay about a year ago, and I've done a lot of therapy in that time, and you know, and so I already remember different things, and I remember different aspects of you know, of her development. And so it's really hard to piece together that development, because you know, there are times when I maybe want to hold on to an image that is linear, right? Where she was kind of happy and full of life and full of energy at one point, and slowly those characteristics started to fade away. But I think things were much less linear than that. I mean, firstly, as I mentioned earlier, you know, she received her diagnosis like when I was like maybe 3 years old, 3 or 4 years old. She also suffered from depression, and there were times when that was bad, and then there were times when she got treatments, and those treatments helped. So you know, she was always a complicated character, and she always had her brilliant sense of humor and her in intelligence and so on. I think, you know, what the illness changed perhaps is I felt it bred a kind of a resentment, I guess, you know, and a kind of, you know, a kind of bitterness. It comes back to the idea of the, you know, the noble sick person. You know, people to her wanted to kind of think of her as someone who was stoically enduring all of this stuff, but you know, she was pretty mad that this had happened to her. It's unfair. She was in terrible pain for, you know, year after year after year after year, and she couldn't live the life that she wanted to live, and she couldn't have the relationships that she wanted to have. So I feel a lot of you know, a lot of resentment, a feeling of having missed out on another kind of life, a feeling of having missed out on having had different kinds of relationships, right? You know, she had grandchildren and she wanted to be able to be active and play with them. right? But instead she would be sitting in a wheelchair and they would come and say something to her and then they would, you know, they would run off.
When did you learn for the first time that she wanted to die, even in an abstract way?
That's a really hard question. Because I wondered if I sensed it for longer than I knew it consciously. And I say that because, you know, in the essay I talk about the fact that she made her first attempt, you know, many years before the assisted suicide, the assisted death, sorry. And I was super shocked, right? And I had a visceral emotional reaction. I mean, it's a huge event to deal with and process that, right? But I also, there was a part of me that wasn't surprised. You know, there was a part of me that saw how much she was suffering and saw that the path ahead was only towards more suffering. And my mum confided in me a lot, even when I was quite young. Like perhaps, you know, perhaps more than was good for me, I'll say. So by the time she made that first attempt, I feel like I already had quite a clear sense that at least a part of her did not want to go on. Right. But I don't know exactly when and where I developed that idea.
She told you after that first attempt that this wasn't really something she still wanted. She didn't want to die. You weren't entirely sure you believed her. And there's maybe her telling you that to make you feel better. And there's maybe her saying that because she also wanted it to be true that she didn't want to die.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's only my opinion, but I personally felt that a part of her continued to want to die, and I feel, yes, it's perfectly possible when that she, you know, said that she didn't, she was saying it for herself as much as for the rest of us, right? I mean, if you do want to die sincerely, right, not ideation but sincerely, but you know that you have to live for the sake of your family, or you've decided that you know, that's the right thing to do, then I think to some extent you do have to keep that desire even from yourself, right? Because otherwise it's always going to be acting upon you and it becomes a threat to the commitment you've made towards staying alive. And obviously I'm speculating, right? Because I can also be speaking to my fears and the feeling of pain and hurt that I experienced as a result of her attempt meant that it became very hard for me to be convinced myself that she, you know, really wanted to stay with us, right? And to stay in the world. And so it could also be that she was telling the truth, but I wasn't able to trust it. So there's a lot of different possibilities in terms of how much truth there was to that claim and for whom it was true.
Robin, you told your mom you understood her wish to die, but you really wanted to think that she could have her family at her side rather than do this in secret. Did you say that at the time without really thinking there would be a way for her to die with help and with the family around?
I think by that time I already knew, that assisted dying was a possibility. I thought it was euthanasia at the time, right? Which is, which is different insofar as the patient doesn't enact the final step towards death. But I think I was aware of these possibilities. I think that there had even been, conversations maybe about Switzerland. So I maybe hadn't fully confronted it as this is what this reality would look like, but I do think that I understood to some extent what I was talking about, yes.
How did she let you know that she had decided to end her life on her own terms in this planned way?
I was living in Berlin and she called me. And the first thing she said was, "This is the hardest conversation I'm ever going to have with you." She was, clearly very nervous about how I would react. It's kind of like when, I don't know, when someone wants to have a breakup and they're really, really nervous, because they love the person, but they know that it can't be for whatever reason. And they're really nervous because they don't want that person to, they don't want to hurt the person they love, right? And they don't want that person to have ill will towards them. So that's how she started the conversation. I don't remember. I have written about it elsewhere, but I don't remember. So I could probably find it, but I don't remember exactly what she said. She called me on the phone. She said, "This is the hardest conversation I'm ever going to have with you." And she told me. Yeah.
I imagine it was an incredibly hard conversation, and hard for you on multiple levels. Hard to hear this, hear that she had made her decision, and also hard because you both wanted to support her, and I can imagine there was a big emotional part of you that wanted to talk her out of it.
I never wanted to talk her out of it. I never wanted to talk her into it. I, made a decision very early on that I didn't want to put myself in a position of responsibility with respect to the question of whether my mum lived or died. Because either way you go, whether you express strong support or you try and talk her out of it, then that puts the question, that makes the question of her death a matter of your agency, right? And I think that that's too much for a daughter to bear, really. Or for this daughter to bear. Like, I think, being in a position where whether I made the right moves or not with regards to how persuasive I could be changed the outcome of whether she lived or died is not a position that I wanted to put myself in, for one. But secondly, I think, we don't choose to be born, and we don't choose the cards we're dealt. And anyone who's ever experienced chronic pain understands how hard that is. I don't think you can really understand unless you've been through it yourself, right? And my own knowledge of chronic pain is from far weaker analogies, far, far weaker experience than what my mum was going through. So, to be in a position of trying to persuade her to live is also, being in a position of saying, like, "I think you should endure all of this pain. I want you to be in all of this pain." And so that's also, that's also not something that I really wanted to push. I wanted to respect you know, respect her decision.
Robin, when the time came for this to happen, you and your brothers gathered with your parents first at their home in Spain for a few weeks, and then you would travel as a family to Switzerland. What was that time like? Were you able to just be together and enjoy each other's company, or was that always sort of weighted with what was to come?
It was always weighted. It was a really bizarre time. Very hard to summarize, right? I mean, I joke, this is one of the reasons why I write is so that I don't have to talk about it, right? Because it's so hard,
yeah,
to sum up the sheer range of things that was going on. But what I will say is that it was, you know, it was challenging, but also, you know, it was the last time that we were all together as a family. And, you know, families are messy things with lots of different personalities and strong feelings. And, you know, I think we all put quite a lot of effort into being there for each other at the time, even though each of us was going through our own individual saga, our individual psychodrama with respect to what was happening, you know. And I think there's a kind of constant movement of, at once, trying to be cognizant of what was happening so that you could prepare for it, and to put it out of mind so that you could cope and just be with, you know, enjoy those last moments, right?
What do you remember about the last thing she said to you?
I mentioned this in the essay, that the last thing she said to me was, you stole my hair, you bastard. which my hair was quite long at the time, and we just had a lot of jokes about it in the run up. And we'd had plenty of time for sentimental conversations, and I think it was very characteristic of her to be able to joke in that moment. And again, it kind of showed her unwavering commitment to her decision to die, the fact that so close to the end, she was kind of still being herself, right? She's still joking about.
Were you able to say everything to her that you wanted to say?
I've asked this question to myself a lot, right? 'Cause when a person dies, your relationship with them carries on. That's what's so strange about grief. Grief is a relationship with someone that's no longer there. That's very confusing. And, you know, much of grief, it feels like it's, you know, making sense of loving something that is no longer there. So I've thought a lot. I came out as a transgender woman about, I don't know, 2.5 years after she died, maybe 2 years after she died. And I was able to come out in part because of therapy I had done to process my grief. And I had come out earlier. I came out the first time about a week after I found out that she was going to die. And I told some people about it, and I started, you know, finding community and so on. Again, this was when I was living in Berlin. And don't remember all the details, but by the time I was with her in Spain, and with the family, that fact about me, I call it the reality of my gender, was very repressed again. So I have that question of like, did I want her to know this about me? Was I scared of how she might receive it or whether she would receive it? You know, like we're kind of taught in our society that to be a gender other than the one you're assigned at birth is wrong, right? Especially when I was growing up. And if you think there's something about you that makes you wrong, then that carries with it a fear of being unlovable and being rejected, right? So, you know, one could get into all sorts of theorizing about why I never told her that and whether I really wanted to and whether I would still want to, right? Maybe I don't want to know the response. Maybe I could also say that I did tell her, right? Because when you're a trans girl and you're like 3-4 years old, you don't really understand that as far as your society is concerned, there's something wrong with the idea that you're a girl. So you say it. you express your confusion about being penned off with what you understand to be the other gender, you know, in my case with the boys. But I also grew up in a time where, you know, there's far less, for better and better or for worse, there's far less discussion around gender than there is now. So obviously when I was 3 years old and 4 years old, it wasn't met with much understanding from my mother. So that's always a question for me. You know, do I wish I could talk to her about that? Or does the fact that I was only able to like fully embrace coming out after she left speak to a complex tangle in our relationship that spoke to why I stayed in the closet for so long? It's a really hard question, and it's something that I have plenty of follow-up essays that I've written an essay recently actually that is kind of trying to explore this in a bit more detail.
It does seem hard, Robin, because you're left with a lot of questions that you will probably be exploring for the rest of your life with regard to how your mother would have responded to this. You won't get a definitive answer. I wonder if, you know, on a Tuesday, you sort of arrive at something that works for you, and then you wake up on Thursday and realize maybe you hadn't considered everything.
You know, I never want to say that I feel settled in my grief, because you're right, you never know what's going to happen on, you know, from Tuesday to Wednesday. I have developed a much more sophisticated understanding of my relationship with my mother than, you know, the one I had even when I wrote this. When I wrote this essay. And in some ways, to me, the question of my relationship with my mother and how I understand that is mostly relevant to questions of how I relate to people in my life now. You know, what how do I give love? How do I accept it? What boundaries do I need to draw sometimes?
Do the circumstances of her death, the fact that she chose to die on her own terms, have any effect whatsoever on the way that you grieve her?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really grateful, actually. I mean, firstly, because who knows how much more pain she would have had to go through. You know, it was a lot. It's a lot for her, and it's not commensurable. It's not comparable. But it's a lot for all of us, right? Her sickness shaped my life. It's not a small thing to grow up with, and I held a great duty of emotional care towards my mother, so she would unburden herself to me. The fact that she was able to do it on her own terms is a real gift. I mean, you know, even in that month leading up to it, which you asked about earlier, I'd always think like, okay, there's something really maddening about the fact that there's a date and it's looming and I know when it's coming. But I was like, most people don't get to know when someone's going to die, you know, and you can't prepare for someone's death. You can't pre-grieve, you know, but like, you know, not knowing when it was going to come, not having it as this thing that could have blasted me out at any moment was, you know, was a gift. Getting to be there with her when it happened and being given the opportunity, you know, whether I said all the things I needed to say or not, being given the opportunity to spend that time and shape according to my needs at the time, the way I wanted to end the relationship. I think all of those factors are very helpful for the grieving process. I think I got a taste of what it would have been like if she had taken her own life without us by her side. It would have come with a big sense of betrayal, right? I mean, I would have had the same understanding to some extent, but I would have also felt like had all these questions of like, oh, wow, you know, you chose this rather than us. You didn't share this. There was something this big that, you know, I didn't know about, and so on. All these unresolved questions that would have been left lingering. So I think that it has made the grief. Grief's never going to be easy. Grief for your mum, you know, whether you have a disastrous relationship, a wonderful relationship, like, you know, grief for your mother is a complicated thing. Overall, I'm really grateful that it was possible to do it this way. You know, when I published the essay and read the comments that people left and saw what people said on social media, you know, there were a lot of people whose mom or their dad or their loved one didn't have this option available to them, you know, because of their where they lived and their own situation and how much they kind of wish that they did, you know. And the short answer is, so yeah, I'm grateful that she was able to have a say over her dignity, her life, everything that she had, have the final say on that at a time in her life when she really didn't have a say on very much, right? Because her illness and a society that isn't very good at coping and supporting sick people took a lot of the rest of her agency away.
Robin Williamson is an author currently completing her MFA at UC Riverside. Her essay for The Audacity was titled The Switzerland Schedule. Robin, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram just by searching for KERA Think. The podcast is available wherever you get podcasts, or you can listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.